Accession number 28354, reel 17.
You were saying about Admiral Gibson.
He managed and organized and come up, supervised that particular demonstration impeccably. It really was very good. It went as smoothly as you could possibly imagine. Not just that our flying went smoothly, which was our responsibility, but all the other movements of ships, of which there was a considerable amount in this demonstration, went absolutely to the minute. It was very good. As was all other Donald's tactical efforts at sea. We did an exercise, the first exercise ever, with a nuclear submarine within a carrier's screen. And that was a well-conducted and interesting experiment. And it was Donald who was in charge of it.
Can you explain the purpose and function of that?
This was an experiment to see whether you could control with using your sonar, could control a submarine as part of your escort, and you'd send it out if some contact was made. I don't think it was a practical thing really, but it was one of the ideas that was going around at the time. Then after unison, we got back in and had a bit of leave. The next bit of sea going in that ship was down to the Mediterranean again, an exercise with, I think it was 3DIV, but whatever division was the mobile division of the British Army at the time, and we did an amphibious exercise off Tripoli, and the Major General in charge of that was Michael Carver, who subsequently became Chief of Defence Staff. We were the carrier supporting the whatever, the orange force or whichever coloured force it was that was doing the assault onto the Libyan beaches. I have no particular recollection of that exercise except General Carver coming on board and absolutely shredding my one army officer. We had what was called a CBLO. He was a Royal Artillery liaison officer. What? CBGLO. I can't remember what it stood for now. But anyway, he was our army liaison officer, a gunner, always a gunner. And ours was not a very... These were always passed over majors that were sent to sea. A very attractive lot, usually. Mine wasn't a very attractive man, nor was he very good. And Michael Carver came into my operations room and started asking these chap questions. Realised that this wasn't one of the greatest soldiers that he was talking to, and he tore this poor man into shreds. It was a very unkind, but perceptive bit of work. That was my first encounter with Michael Carver. I was to see much more of him later. After a final trip to Denmark, to Copenhagen, in Hermes, I brought her back to Plymouth. We must be in 1964 now. I brought her back to Plymouth and paid her off there. After, I suppose, about 2 years and 4 months in command, nearly 2.5 years in command. I was rather pleased with myself because I was very pleased myself to have had command for so long, because you didn't usually get a command of longer than 18 months at that time. And to have 2 years and over it was a luxury. But also commanding a carrier was pretty tense and wearing and worrying to anybody, however good they might be. And I was terribly pleased that there I was at the end of all this time. I was fit and well, had come through it without any problems at all. And I then went on a skiing holiday to Norway, and started coughing rather a lot. Well, didn't think much of it, but came back to London, and then suddenly one night I woke up coughing somewhat differently. I had got whooping cough. And this really brought me down to ground. Here I've been so pleased with myself. I got no problems after commanding Hermes for 2 years, and I went crash with whooping cough. 2 days later, I was so ill that I was rushed across London to an army hospital in Woolwich with all the bells ringing in the ambulance, because my temperature was about something like 105. I'd got malaria as well. So that took me down to earth. I was pretty sick for a while. I got all sorts of get well cards from the ship, and then one of them gave me an extract from my own orders, which were the instructions that you should take one mepocrine a day in order not to get malaria, and I obviously had not taken my own dose, which was not a just accusation. I had done so. And I was vindicated about 6 months later when I read an Admiralty Fleet order which said when you're in Mombasa you take not one mepocrine but two, because the virulence of the disease in Kilindini, just to the south of Mombasa. So I was vindicated, but I was quite sick for a while. There'd been a lot of talk about what next job I was going to have, and Donald Gibson kept telling me that I was going to go as Assistant Chief of Naval Staff, which was of course on the operational side of the Ministry of Defence. And in the event, what I did was go as Naval Secretary. I was appointed Naval Secretary, relieving for the third time Jock Hayes. I'd relieved him as appointments commander. I relieved him as a captain, as deputy director of plans, and I now relieved him as naval secretary. I wasn't sorry. As I've said already, I love dealing with people rather than with things, and I didn't like the Whitehall political scene very much, so I was very pleased to be naval secretary.
Can I just ask at this stage, you don't like the Whitehall scene very much? Did you at any stage now in your career think that you could go to the very top, which meant that, with the possibility even of being first, that you would therefore have to get involved with the Whitehall scene and gen up a bit on
that? I didn't see there was a chance of my being First Sea Lord, no. I really didn't think that I was First Sea Lord caliber. And of course, self-evidently, if I thought about it, yes, I would need that experience, yeah. And I didn't have it.
But you didn't seek it?
Didn't
try and manoeuvre yourself so that you got it?
No, never. No, no, no. No, I didn't have that kind of ambition. No, I don't think. Now, I don't remember ever thinking at that sort of stage that I would be a First Sea Lord. It was only later circumstances show that I could have been, I was in the running for it, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, we'll come to that.
Yeah. Naval Secretary, at that time, he has a much bigger job now, a much wider one, merely dealt with admirals and captains. All of them. It had in the past been Naval Secretary to the First Lord. This is prior to the establishment of an integrated Ministry of Defence. And the First Lord, still had what was the patronage. It's interesting, this dates back, right back, when there were two things that you wanted to do as a sea officer. One was to go to sea in command of a ship, and the other was to command a ship that gave you good prize money. Therefore, there was a particular patronage in the hands of the First Lord, the political boss of the Navy, into what place he sent you. And if you were his friend, perhaps he'd send you wherever it was that the prize money was going well at that time, or there was a good chance of getting it. It was known as the First Lord's patronage, and it remained. And therefore, the Naval Secretary, until my time, was responsible to the First Lord, not to the First Sea Lord. It's very interesting that this sort of gone on for so long. But when I took over, which George Jellicoe was Minister of the Navy, he had been first Sea Lord, and in the transfer to the Ministry of Defence, he became Minister of the Navy. But George, fortunately for me, still carried on in the old ways and took the Naval Secretary with him wherever he went, as his sort of his naval advisor. So for, in fact, for all my time in the ministry, Minister of Defence as Naval Secretary, I followed the First Sea Lord, the First Lord, George Jellicoe to start with, and then Christopher Mayhew afterwards, wherever they went. But
Christopher Mayhew with the change of government in October 64.
That's right, yes. But in the matter of actual appointments of senior officers, I dealt with the First Sea Lord, telling the First Lord what was going, yes, but First Lord wasn't the executive chap who said, yes, send this chap there, send that chap there. Entirely the First Sea Lord. The First Sea Lord was David Luce, an extremely nice man. I'd known him well in the Far East. Unfortunately, probably not the First Sea Lord to have had at that time. This is the time of the battle with the aircraft carriers, because, of course, with the change of government, when George Jellicoe, who ceased to be my minister, in came Dennis Healy. But before that happened, George went on a trip to the Far East. And that was good fun. I mean, I followed him around. We went to Singapore, we went to Hong Kong, and we went to North Borneo, because confrontation was on at that time. And in addition to his naval duties, George is an ex-SOE man, an SAS man or whatever, insisted on going up to the front line to see what the SAS was doing. And there we met, I think he was colonel then, probably, I think he was a general, yes, he's colonel, de la Billière, who became very famous later on, of course, as a SAS man, and commanding our forces in the First Gulf War. I was very impressed with this. I'd not met the SAS before. But what amused me was that here was the Minister of the Crown, no longer a member of the Cabinet, but the Minister of the Crown, who was talking to the SAS on the border between Borneo, between our part, between Malaysia and Indonesia, and discussing the operation that was about to take place with three men who were all dressed up ready to go on it. And perfectly obviously they were going to cross the border, because they couldn't do the operation without it, whereas at home in the Parliament, the Minister of Defence was saying that we never crossed the border, nobody ever went into Indonesia, and here was George talking to all these people who were about to go there.
Can I just ask, you said that David Luce was possibly not the best first to have whilst the carrier debate was going on. Why was that?
That was because I don't think he succeeded in mustering the arguments which were there existing in order to overthrow the RAF's contentions about the carriers and the capability of the Royal Air Force to supersede them with shore-based aircraft. We lost that battle, as is well known. I may be wrong, but David had John Frewin as his VCNS, who's a very strong character. But of course, I wasn't in on this battle. We were fighting the battle for not just the aircraft carrier, but for CVA-01, which was that's the future aircraft carrier, and CVA-01 was an enormous vessel, part of the we lost the argument in part because we held on to our demand that it was that aircraft carrier or nothing, whereas in the bottom drawer of the First Sea Lord's office, since Caspar John's time, when Caspar John was First Sea Lord, there was a thing which was known, I believe, as the Pike Carrier, where Air Marshal Pike, who was then, actually Marshal Pike, who was then Chief of the Air Staff, wrote Caspar John, First Sea Lord, a letter, Caspar John being an aviator, saying that, look, he would support smaller carriers, but he couldn't support the big one. But Caspar John wanted the big one. Caspar John was David Luce's predecessor. And so did the Fleet Air Arm want the big one, and the Navy decided to go for the big one. And here my Frank Hopkins was Fifth Sea Lord and Deputy Chief of Naval Staff, and here I think my beloved Frank, who I liked so much, was mistaken. He was an aviator who wanted the best. And I'm sure, in fact I'm in absolutely no doubt, that we should have compromised with smaller carriers. We might have got them. I don't think it's certain we'd have got them, because Dennis Healy was pretty determined. He came into that job without any doubt, with one of his aims was to get rid of the aircraft carrier. He didn't believe in them, and he situated every appreciation on the subject, in such a way that the answer came out against the, this is what we thought, against the aircraft carrier. So that's why I said David Luce was perhaps the right chap there. I don't think he was a strong enough fighter in that forum of the chiefs of staff. Whereas the Air Chief Marshal, who's that New Zealander, very nice, fine man, who was chief of the air staff. Just stop a minute, I'll get his name. Air Chief Marshal Sir Sam Elworthy is the name I'm trying to get. He was a brilliant staff officer and strategist, an extremely good brain. I think he'd been legally trained, I'm not sure. And at his side was, as a deputy chief of air staff, was our vice marshal, Peter Fletcher. Peter Fletcher had been a Rhodesian lawyer, and I'm not sure he wasn't Attorney General, but anyway, in that office in Rhodesia before he joined the Royal Air Force. I'd served with him. He'd been one of the RAF's deputy director of plans in the latter part of my time there. And he was very tough. And he could argue the philosophy of the nuclear bomb in a way that left me absolutely speechless. I never had any way of replying. And I have a feeling that David Luce found himself speechless facing this legal barrage from the other side. They were two very clever, able men, and they had an axe to grind, and they ground it. I don't think that David Luce and his lot had the intellectual and political skills, so to speak, to match those. In particular, when the Secretary of State was behind them anyway, and he was, there's no doubt about that. There we are. So, Naval Secretary, I wasn't in on this battle, I just saw it from the side. I was in the Far East, wasn't I? It was George Jellicoe.
Yes.
I better get back from there. Nothing much more happened there. But it might be of interest to say the second time that I went out to the Far East was with Christopher Mayhew while I was a Naval Secretary. This is confrontation still on, and we did all the same things. Indeed, we went to sea and put on a patrol in the Singapore Strait. But
was the Labour government's, the new Labour government, they were equally happy to say one thing in the House of Commons whilst knowing that there were incursions into Indonesia?
That didn't arise.
Ah.
That didn't. We didn't go up into Borneo. No, that didn't arise. No, no. We went to Hong Kong, and Christopher Mayhew was briefed by the flag officer second in command, who was then Peter Hill Norton, and it was a very, very good briefing indeed. Very impressive. It covered everything. And we got into the car to drive back to the governor's residence, where Christopher was staying. So was I. And on the way back, Christopher Mayhew leant over to me and said, remember that the battle, this battle was on already. Christopher Mayhew being a supporter of the carrier, the battle was on already. And he said, Bill, that's what the Navy needs more of. And I said, what? More of what? And he said, bastards. Which was a very remarkable statement. He'd only seen Peter Hill Norton for about half an hour, and he's heard this briefing. But he was quite right. What we perhaps needed Peter Hill Norton back in the Ministry of Defence at that time, in that battle, and to help it, whether we wanted it or not, is of course one never know. But he was obviously already concerned, Christopher Mayhew, that we were losing that battle, and we were losing it in part because we were too nice, he was saying. And here was a not very nice man who might do the battle better. I liked Christopher Mayhew, and I admired his intellectual prowess and his perception. He was quite an astute man. And sadly, of course, his political career ended because he did remain in support of the carrier and resigned from his position with David Luce when the pair of them resigned. I don't think he ought to resign personally. Christopher Mayhew was a limited supporter of the carrier. He supported the carrier so long as we maintained a Far East policy, that's to say a fleet in the Far East and all the commitments that we had in the Far East. I don't think Christopher would have supported the carrier just if we were a home navy, which, so to speak, we became. But there we are. He lost his job and his political career over the aircraft carrier. And that was all in my time, roughly, as Naval Secretary. Naval Secretary was quite fun in that you had very little, really not very much work to do. The actual appointing side was done easily within the time scale allowed. You had time to go swanning off with your minister all around the world, various places around all the ports. I suppose we visited everywhere with those two at some time or another, everywhere in England. And you also were, in some curious way, liaison with the attachés. It was all the foreign attachés in London. It was a fairly tenuous association, but it meant that you went to all the parties at the embassies, and it meant my wife had to do quite a lot of entertaining without anybody to cook for her, as we returned hospitality from all these attaches with whom we came quite friendly. They were rather a nice lot, we found. Our particular friend was the Italian naval attache. So I think that'll end my talk of being naval secretary.
You're still a captain, of course.
No, Rear Admiral. I beg your pardon. I was promoted to Rear Admiral on leaving Hermes.
How many years were you a captain?
Your captain for, I think it was 9 years at that time. Maybe it was eight.
And you served the 9 years?
Yes, you very rarely was anybody picked out earlier. In fact, never at that time was anybody picked up earlier. You went to the end of the end of the run.
Your age at this time would have been...
Well, I was promoted in 1964, so that makes me being born in 1916. That makes me 48. Yes. Yes.
48.
I was 47 when I was promoted, actually.
Yes.
And 48 soon after. I was 47 when I was promoted, yes. Yeah.
Was that about normal?
No, it was young.
Young to be a rear admiral at 47, yes, 48.
Yeah. Youngish, anyway.
Youngish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You still didn't perceive yourself as a high flyer?
Well, I was obviously not doing badly. Well, I was promoted to commander on my first shot, I suppose. First or second, anyway, perhaps it was second shot. And to captain pretty quickly.
And of course, getting to commander is your most important.
Yeah, that was
really
that was a big step. Yes, yes. Got you out of the ruck. yes, I was obviously doing all right. For all sorts of reasons, I never saw myself first at all. In particular, I didn't see myself in this political melee in Whitehall. And when I'd been in it in a small way, I'd found myself not good at it. I mean, Peter Fletcher, I'm talking now, when we were arguing, this is the time just after the transfer of the nuclear deterrent from the Royal Air Force
to the Navy.
In fact, it hadn't actually taken place then, but I found myself in the arguments about these things. I found myself outmaneuvered by more intellectual people. I hadn't got the background or the education to it. Others were much better at it. I stayed silent. They argued. There we are. Now I went to see the First Sea Lord, David Luce, and he said I was going to be Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers. That caused me enormous pleasure, I must say, because I'd been inoculated with the Fleet Air Arm, and I'd loved it and admired it very much. And the idea of going as its admiral, so to speak, was a tremendous honour, I thought. And so I relieved a chap called Dick Janbrin, who was an aviator, and moved down to Portsmouth. Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers had just set himself up with a shore office at Fort Southwick on the hill above Portsmouth, one of those old Palmerston forts. And I was just being set up, though it hadn't finished, with a nice little flat within there to which my wife could come. I started off living in the barracks in Portsmouth when I was ashore. But the office was already up at Fort Southwick. The chief staff officer of Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers was a chap called Ed Brown, an observer whom I'd met various times when I was captain of Hermes and taken to tremendously. He was a likeable chap and such a knowledgeable aviator and such a very sensible, calm, quiet man that I was delighted to find that he was there as chief of staff, and he saw me through my time. Oh, that's not quite right. I beg your pardon. The chief of staff to start with was a chap called John Roberts, another aviator, and he was subsequently relieved by Ed Brown, which gave me such pleasure. John Roberts was all right, but I never got close to him as a friend, whereas Ed Brown became a very close personal friend. Very soon, in fact, almost at once after I took over as Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers, I flew out to the Far East, to Singapore, via Aden. In fact, I was had a horrible thing to do. I was the man carrying the 1966 Defence White Paper for the commanders-in-chief in Aden and Singapore to read in advance of its publication. So I had this great document, which I delivered to these two, which was killing the aircraft carrier. And I can't remember who was it. Oh, there was that very nice general at Aden to whom I passed it on to, but his name has gone from me. And then I flew on to Singapore and gave it to the Chief Marshal, who was then Commander-in-Chief. That name's gone too, but never mind. And to Frank Twiss, who was commanding the Far East Fleet. Frank, I think, supported this particular white paper, in fact. I think he supported the demise of the aircraft carrier. I'm not sure quite why, but I think he did. I obviously didn't. Now, one of his subordinate flag officers while I was out there. And I then went on board HMS Eagle, and by this extraordinary coincidence, as a fishhead admiral, hoisted my flag in an aircraft carrier, as flag officer aircraft carriers, on the day that the demise of an aircraft carrier was announced. You'd think that might have been a rather delicate time to be in all among these angry aviators, seeing their livelihood and their hopes and everything being shattered. And curious enough, it wasn't. They were terribly good. There were some who were so upset that they quit. But on the whole, it was, you bastards, we'll show you. We'll show you you're wrong. And, we'll dig in.
How do you do that when you're going to be abolished? How do you show someone that this decision is wrong?
You hope that it... I mean, political decisions are changed, aren't they? And indeed this one was, but over time, it took a little time to...